For me, education doesn't need to be for free. A root setter, he makes his living out of it. It's a profession. So if you follow a professional education, you can pay for it. It doesn't need to be hyper expensive neither. Our own events, the World Championship and then the World Cups, how do you give them value? The easy answer is the prize money. There was some controversy about it, clearly. Now, this year, the Neom Games aren't on the schedule anymore. At World Cup level, there has been tests done, I think 300 tests last year. There has been talks with specific athletes that are getting into the danger zone, but not there yet.
Welcome to another episode of the That's Not Real Climbing podcast. I'm your host, Jenny, and I'm excited to introduce my guest for today, Tyle Smits. Tyle is currently the IFSC Europe president, but is now running for the president of IFSC with elections taking place in April. In this episode, we'll learn about how IFSC politics works, hear about the changes he wants to make within the IFSC, and get his take on some hot topic issues like national federation quotas, Red S testing, and the Neom Games. I really appreciate him being willing to answer some difficult questions, so I hope you enjoy this episode with Tyle. Real quick, I'm excited to announce my new sponsor helping make this podcast episode possible, Mad Rock Climbing. I got fitted with their brand new line of high-performance shoes, the D2.1s. They just came out December 6th, but you might notice a few of your favorite GOM climbers are already wearing them, like Oscar Beaudrand from Team Canada, and also me. This is the first time I've gotten to wear their shoes for an extended period of time, and I'm actually super impressed with the grip of their in-house rubber, and of course, the famous drone heel that everyone says is the cheat code to heel hooking small edges. Feel free to message me if you have any questions about the shoes or sizing, and you can use the discount code NOTREALCLIMBER for 10% off your entire MadRock order. Info will be in the description. Back to the show. So yeah, let's just get right into a little bit of your history. Some easy questions before we get into like the hot button issues.
Okay.
So how did you start climbing? And for those who don't know you, what do you do for the IFSC?
So I started climbing. Being little, I always loved climbing in trees. And I watched sometimes when we were visiting south of France, we were with my parents in the Verdon Valley, and we saw climbers on the walls. And it was impressive for me. And then we went hiking in the mountains in Austria. And I really loved pictures of people climbing, free climbing in the 80s style with the pink pants and etc. So I was quite impressed by that. And in the end, only when I was 18 years old, I managed to start climbing in an indoor gym. And I was immediately hooked up. I wanted to climb 3 times a week. And it was really a new passion I discovered. And soon I also discovered climbing on the rocks, which was even more my thing, apparently. I really loved being outdoors and then climbing. So that's the way how I started, from trees to walls to the rocks. And then since I was studying sports education, I was really motivated with some people in the climbing gym to somehow share the passion and to allow kids to start climbing. So we quite soon launched a club. I climbed merely 1 year when we started with some friends, a club for small kids to educate them in the climbing, since it aligned with my studies as well. So that's how I started somehow in the climbing business as well. As a volunteer though, not as a business.
Right, yeah.
That's how I started climbing. And how did I end up in the IFSC? Well, during sports education, I managed to become a coach of the Belgian climbing team when being on international competitions at the World Championships in Indonesia. In Singapore, sorry. In 2012, there was a rule that said that if there was a tight spot at the gold medal place, then based upon the speed of climbing in the finals of the lead, there would be defined who is the winner. And between all coaches, we thought like, oh, this is not wrong. This is wrong. It should not be based on time because it is lead climbing, not speed climbing. So at that point, with all the coaches, we decided to send an email to the IFSC complaining and asking like, can this rule be changed? And by the way, don't we need a coaches representative in the IFSC? Okay, at IFSC level, we didn't manage to get a coaches representative for the youth events at that moment, but we did get in the IFSC Europe Sport Commission. And I was lucky to be chosen as the coach's representative. At the same time, I started a full-time position inside the Belgian Federation as sports director, and they decided to send me to the General Assemblies as National Federation's delegate. And so that way I rolled into it. I liked it. I liked to bring opinions of people together and to make sure that we all had our say and that the general opinion was respected. And so in 2021, the National Federations of Europe decided to elect me as their president for IFSC Europe, which also brought me into the IFSC board. So the last 4 years, I have been part of the IFSC board as Europe representative, and I have been IFSC Europe president thanks to the trust that the National Federations gave me.
I don't know if I knew that you were the Belgian coach. How long were you doing that for?
Oh, I think my first year coaching or my first competition was in 2007, was my first taste. I could go to Kranj, to the youth cup that we had, the European Youth Cup organized in Kranj in Slovenia back in the old days. And then from the year after, I was full-time coaching the youth team. And so, yeah, from 2007 or 8 rather, till 2019, I was actively coaching, and 2020, Corona, there was no coaching. 2021, 2022, I still had to do some, I had to fill in some holes where we didn't have other coaches available, but I was already less coaching because in the end, there is a possible conflict of interest between being the president of IFSC Europe and being a coach. So I was more in the background, allowing a bit more the logistic side and not actively appealing or those things, but I was still helping a bit. So yeah, like roughly 15 years, but maybe a bit less.
Yeah, that's a long time. How did you like coaching?
Oh, I loved coaching a lot. Sometimes I still miss it in the end. I love a lot to climb myself, but I love also to show people that they can be stronger than they thought they could be, or that they can surpass themselves, and somehow guide them in the process to discover how to use their body and how to put goals and to go for new goals. So I really like to work with kids mostly, but I also coached adults for a long time. That was my way of earning my money. I was in the end, before I started working for the Belgian Federation, I was an independent climbing coach working as a volunteer for the youth team in my city, and as a professional for seniors, for adults, in fact, as well, debutants, beginners, as experts. So yeah, I love to teach people how to climb. But then since I got more and more involved in the management of sports climbing, in the end, at a certain time, I could not combine both anymore. Also, if you coach people, you need to have trust. And if you manage a team, somehow you also decide who gets money, who doesn't get money. So people maybe they are not able to tell you the full truth anymore at all moments somehow. Because if you tell to the one who is giving the money that you're injured, maybe you get less money, or there is the fear of not getting selected and those things. So, and also just on my own side as well, I didn't have time anymore for coaching really seriously, being fully focused on the performance of the athletes. And in the end, the athlete deserves a coach who is fully focused on them and who doesn't need to take care of the overall management of the federation. So it was a choice, but I still miss it sometimes, definitely.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that definitely makes sense. I mean, do you still do any like professional, like adult coaching, since that's not really... There's no conflict of interest there?
There is no conflict of interest, but there is a conflict of schedule. So
sure.
I even stopped coaching adults sooner than I stopped coaching youth. The passion really is to help young people to grow. And I didn't need it that much anymore for the money side, because I had a full-time job already at that time. So I stopped with adult coaching in 2015, I think. But I continued with the youth later on. But yeah, of course, if there is friends of mine who start climbing now, or that want some advice, I happily give advice, and I tend maybe even to give too much advice, because I still have the coaching habit in me. When I go climbing with friends, I need to slow down a bit in my tips to them, because sometimes it should be for fun and not for training also.
Right, sure. Do you have like a number one tip or like mindset for coaching that you want to get out there?
On the technical side, I definitely like one exercise for each and every level of climber. It maybe sounds stupid, but a beginner, if you tell them to climb in silence where you don't hear the feet on the footholds, that's a good one. But in the end, even a strong climber, if he focuses once in a while on being silent with the feet, it's a good thing to focus once more on this specific analytical part of climbing. It's my favorite exercise for all beginners and even intermediate level. That's for sure. And then, yeah, the one big thing is enjoy what you do and seek the things that give you pure joy and don't start doing things because you think that you have to do them. Joy is most important, I think.
Awesome. Okay. So going back to, logistical IFSC side of things. So you are running for IFSC president. How does this process work?
Okay. So every 4 years, there is elections in the IFSC for the full board, unless you take, you don't need to take into account the athletes' representatives because they are elected by the athletes during the World Championships. Every 2 years, there is the half of the election of the athletes' commission that is elected. So that's a separate election process, but all the board members, vice presidents and president position, they get elected every 4 years. And indeed, this year, some of the board members are not allowed to represent themselves again. However, Marco Scolaris, he asked for an exception because of all the merit he brought to this project and because there still might be the need to continue with him as president, so he can represent himself this year, but of course other candidates can appear as well, and I am one of the other candidates. I don't know if there will be others for the president's position. In the end, we only confirmed our candidacies this week with the IFSC, and they still go through the nomination committee with all the candidates, and then this needs to be confirmed towards all national federations. So all those board positions can have candidates, and the nomination committee decides if the candidates are eligible or not. And so the different board positions are president, vice president, or continental representative. That's a bit the different positions that are going for elections every 4 years.
Okay, so he's not like necessarily stepping down. This is just something that happens every 4 years.
Every 4 years there is elections, and there can be candidates, as many candidates as there are people interested to do so. Yeah, I think this year there will be many candidates because, yeah, it's been a long time that the IFSC is growing. We are Olympic now. There is some board members that cannot stand again for being part of the board. So there is vacant positions in any case, and there is some interest, I think. So we will have interesting elections, and hopefully we will have an interesting team of board members starting from April onwards.
And you don't know who like any of the other candidates are at the moment?
Oh, we have, of course, the rumors circulating and some people that are saying it's allowed. So for present, maybe there is only two persons, Marco Scolaris and me. But then for vice president, so there is four vice presidents, I believe, on the female vice president side. So there is two positions, which should be female, and two positions which are male. I believe on the female side, there is two candidates. On the male side, there might be four or five candidates. So it can be a tough competition there with all valuable candidates. So the national federations will have hard choices also on that level. And then for the continental representatives, I believe that in the different continents, there have been some talks. But still, I think also there might be multiple candidates for each continent. So it's going to be interesting elections for sure.
And I guess, sorry if this is a basic question, but like who's voting for this, or like who decides?
Good question. Definitely a good question. So all the national federations of the IFSC have a vote. It's one vote per national federation. I think we have 101 national federations nowadays. We're still growing. So sometimes change. So I think the count now is 101 national federations that can vote during the General Assembly, which happens in Cyprus. And there is three options for voting. So or you are there in person, or you can participate online with online voting, or you can even give a proxy vote another national federation. So the democratic process is quite wide, I would say. Participation is highly encouraged, I would say.
Okay, great. Okay, so then going into some of the things that, I guess things that you might want to change or problems that you would want to work on. What things are the IFSC focused on right now that you don't think are as important or that they don't need to be as focused on?
It's a tricky question you ask, because I don't think that the focuses that are existing now are not as important. Because, for example, the main focus of the last 17 years was being part of the Olympic Games. And that stays, of course, a very important point for the future as well. But we managed to be in the Olympic Games up till now, two times already. We are confirmed for Los Angeles also as a program sport. So I think we've shown our value in the Olympic Games. We are part of the Olympic family now. So that's somehow achieved. And I think indeed that over the last 70 years, there have been a strong operational focus. And also at board level, we have been focused on delivering these Olympic Games. And that has been good. But now that we're in there, I think we need to step up to the next level. And it is important now that we somehow shift from being operationally focused to having real long-term strategy to work broadly, more widely, and then definitely having a development focus where we help all national federations to grow. Because in the end, the Olympic Games, it's a very good goal to have, but only roughly 20 national federations manage to participate in the Olympic Games because we have limited medals, we have limited quota places. So all the 81 other national federations, so to say, they don't get necessarily the push from their National Olympic Committee. They don't get the recognition, or it is more difficult to get that recognition. It's more difficult to develop. You cannot say, we have an Olympian, so please, sponsors, come and help us. No, it's they still need to get to the level of the Olympic Games. So I believe that having an Olympic focus for the future, it is still needed, even a Paralympic focus, because we are part of the Paralympic Games now as well. But on the other side, there should be a huge focus on development and making sure that we all grow globally. All continents, all national federations get a chance to develop furthermore. I think that's the main focus for the future, the development of the national federations.
We'll definitely get into like the development portion a little bit later. I guess just real quick about the Olympic Games. As a program sport, does that mean that we still might like get kicked out in the future, or does that mean we're like forever in the Olympics?
In the past, we would say, yeah, once you're a program sport, you're in the Olympics forever. However, it is changing more and more. I think the phrase they use nowadays is the sliding doors. So it might happen that you stay in, it might happen that you get kicked out, but it depends a bit on the value you have. So indeed, we have been invitational sport in Tokyo and in Paris. It's in the end Tokyo who choose to invite us. Firstly, Paris confirmed that invitation as well. For Los Angeles, the IOC decided to include us in the full program, but for Brisbane, this confirmation has not been given yet. Of course, since we are now a program sport, we somehow hope that this means that somehow there is a confirmation at least for 2-3 editions in a row, but we don't have that confirmation and we still need to show that we are there and that we deserve to be there. So we still have an operational challenge there to really deliver good games, definitely.
Okay, so then going forward, what kind of changes do you want to make, or what do you feel like you're most focused on?
So as mentioned already before, I think development is the main one. So going from only the operational focus, getting to development. And I think within development, the most obvious way to push development is by education. Up till now, IFSC has been focused on education programs for route setters and for judges, and quite specifically on the needs that they have for the events, or that we as IFSC, I mean, have for the events that we organize ourselves. So mainly the World Cups and also the continental events. But in the end, I think that we need to push route setting and judging also at a global level for all national federations. We need to make sure that all national federations get the experience from the international level at least brought to them. So every national federation should get the opportunity to have someone who learns at least the highest level of route setting or learns the highest level of judging and can bring that experience and that knowledge to their country and make sure that it gets educated there as well. But it's not only about route setters and about judges, it's also about coaches teaching the athletes in how to develop themselves, teaching the administrators in how we can market our sport, how we can grow our sport, how we make sure that we do good safeguarding of all people involved. Not only the athletes need safeguarding, everyone involved somehow needs to be taken care of. So it's really about a lot of different educational programs that we could launch. I also think, for example, of the belayers for lead climbing. It's really important that you have certified belayers that really know how to belay in a good way. All those kinds of educational programs might be very useful for the future. So yeah, I think that's the main focus. And then secondly, I think also that for the IFSC and in the end for every organization in the world, probably sustainability should be a big one. And if I speak of sustainability, I don't only talk about the environmental part, because people tend to say like, oh, sustainability, yeah, but it's all about nature. And in the end, there is other things that are more important for a sports organization. But I believe that sustainability, it's about economic, it's about social and environmental sustainability. And for economic, it means that you create the good economic environment for the sport to flourish. So you make sure that there is a structure behind that grows and that somehow makes it possible to finance ourselves in a better way. So by an event model which has indeed the World Championship and the World Cups as main events and the Olympic Games above all that. But of course, then you also need to have the continental level, you need to have a regional level, you need to facilitate somehow even the development of national events, etc., etc. Branding around this, marketing around this. So making the full economic environment and the full structure of how we function, making it interesting to maintain and in the long run. And on the social level, it's about taking care of our volunteers. It's about taking care of the route setters, of the judges, making sure that, for example, judges and volunteers, they get somehow the compensation they deserve and that they feel that they can contribute in a positive way and they don't get used, but they are really part of the family. Or route setters, I've heard of route setters that also have injuries in the end, and then you need to make sure that they can work in healthy conditions and that they can also, if they get injured, that they don't fall without work, that they have something to continue living. So that's a bit the social part, making sure that somehow people can live off their passion. And of course, environmental is also part of everything, because the world, we only have one planet. But I think sustainability, it's even more on the economic and the social part than the environmental part. If you do good first two, probably the third one will also become better, because you use better the resources you have. You don't abuse the resources, but you use your resources in a healthy way. So that's how I think that sustainability is important. And if I can add one more, so there was development and education, there was sustainability in its three different aspects. And then lastly, a focus for me is teamwork and cooperation, because in the end, it's not only on board level, but I mean, each and every stakeholder in the full organization should be part of the team. And if you work well with the national federations, with the continental councils, with the commissions, with the office, of course, with other stakeholders, with experts, and if you make sure that each and everyone is involved and that there is a sharing of knowledge and an exchange of good habits and of maybe also the mistakes that have been made, so everyone learns from each other, I think that will allow the organization to really grow to its best potential.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. I guess the main thing that comes to mind for me is like the funding issue, and it seems like, I mean, we always talk about how there's like not really enough funding in climbing or competition climbing specifically. And then I think like with funding, you kind of need that money there to be able to start like these educational processes and everything like that. Do you have an idea of like how to increase the funding? Because that seems like something that no one really knows how to tackle.
It's not that no one knows. It is indeed a very difficult question, but it's the full package that you need to grow in order to solve this funding issue. So funding indeed is the basis of everything, how you fund things. And of course, for example, we largely hope or base ourselves on Olympic funding, but in the end, we never had a lot of Olympic funding, and we had to look for other opportunities. So in the end, over the last 70 years, I believe the IFSC has done already a very good job in obtaining more and more funding and in growing the image of the sport. So that's one thing you need to work on the different revenue streams that you might have. And I think there has been done already a very good job till now. But we can still do more if you really work on a good event model. And if next to that event model, you do good branding and you do good marketing, you can find more options than we have nowadays. And over the last years, we have seen that there has been some interesting new deals happening. One clear example is that in Europe now we are on Eurosport, and Eurosport gives the possibility of to millions and millions of viewers to watch our sport. So somehow the importance of our sport has grown over the last years, and that's the way we need to go. And I definitely believe that with our appearance in the Tokyo Games, in Paris Games, this is even pushed furthermore. So it is by making good events, by doing good branding around the events, by doing good marketing, that we will manage at IFSC level. But in the end, you also allow the same happening at continental level and the same happening at national level. Just to explain, at continental level in Europe, we started a YouTube channel 2 or 3 years ago. I'm not 100% certain when we started, but so in the past, we didn't have this specific European YouTube channel for our European Youth Cups and for our European Cups. But that's also making sure that we get more visibility at a continental level. If you have visibility, you can build an image. If you have an image, you can do good branding around this, and you can do marketing around this. That's one example. Or at national level, since we are in Europe now on Eurosport, and I believe in other continents there is also more and more visibility. So since you are more visible on the television, in the end, as a national federation, you can also look for more visibility for your national events. The overall knowledge of the public of the sport is growing. So yeah, this creates more and more possibilities. That's for the event side. And since you also mentioned the educational side, I want to dig into that one as well. For me, education doesn't need to be for free. A route setter, he makes his living out of it. It's a profession. So if you follow a professional education, you can pay for it. It doesn't need to be hyper expensive neither. But up till now, I think lots of these programs have been financed by solidarity programs. But why can't we ask a little contribution of the ones following the courses, so that somehow we create a fund, a budget, or an auto-financing system, I would say. So everyone who follows an educational program, he pays a little bit. We get a little bit of gain out of this, and this gain we can automatically reinvest in more educational programs. And this in all the different kinds of courses. So in this way, I think we can really find with the IFSC many ways of creating revenue. And if we keep investing everything in further development, I don't think this is wrong to do.
I guess the thing that comes to mind about that is I've heard that maybe the route setters don't get paid so much for setting for like IFSC events, or I guess mainly for like IFSC events. I don't know about for the Olympics. So if they have to also like pay for their development, does that kind of create like what's the word? I guess like a barrier for certain people to improve their skills?
Okay, so I definitely agree that we could or we should maybe be able to pay people more for what they do. And I'm not talking only about the route setters. There is also judges. There is many, many people involved that maybe deserve to get more. But it all starts from what you have as income. Then you can see how much you can give as outgoing towards people as well. I believe it has grown over the last 17 years already. So we're going into the good direction, and I think we need to continue this. So that's the first thing. I definitely agree that people deserve to earn fair money. Secondly, do you make it or do you create a barrier if you ask people to pay for education? I don't think so. As long as this helps to make the education qualitative, I think it's a win, because in the end, you make sure that people obtain diplomas or experience which will help them to be better in their jobs. And in the end, it's not only the IFSC events, it's only a small part of the events that happen worldwide, and the commercial routes, I think it's even next to that, a completely different story. So I think if you allow people to get the experience and the knowledge to do well their jobs, then asking, I definitely said a small amount or a small contribution. I didn't say a huge amount. It should be a bit more than break even in the end. And that way, I think we can make more courses happen. We can educate more people. These people go back to where they live and work with more knowledge and more experience. So somehow it will allow a cascading effect for growing the sport.
Sounds good. And then also earlier when you were talking about like the Eurosport deal for funding, I'm in the US, so I don't know too much about that. I still just watch it on YouTube. But yeah, I definitely know that there was a lot of talk about Eurosport and the difficulties it made for some people in Europe to watch climbing. What has been the outcome of that deal? Do you find that it's been positive? Like, is it easy to watch on the I guess channel? Has it increased viewership?
Yeah, definitely. So in the end, indeed, there has been a lot of talks, but because of Eurosport, we had to geo-block the YouTube channel in Europe, which is somehow sad, because you don't allow your nearest friends and family to watch it for free on YouTube, and you need to pay to view it on Eurosport. But in the end, the numbers of people that can watch sports climbing on Eurosport are completely different to the numbers that we obtain if we use our YouTube channel. So somehow you just give the sport a much wider coverage, or no, not coverage. I mean, there's just many more people that are watching the sport, that are getting interested in the sport. It's about millions of people. I don't have the exact numbers. Fabrizio Rossini from the office, the communications, head of communications, he knows the exact numbers, and the difference is just huge. So yeah, I think it definitely makes a difference. And yeah, it makes the difference that people in the streets now, they can talk about climbing. They know bouldering, they don't lead climbing, they definitely know speed climbing, which still is the most easy to appreciate, apparently. But yeah, it helps. It makes a huge difference.
Okay. So then I guess going into one of like the more harder issues that I had in mind, also sort of related to viewership. Do you have any thoughts on some of the biggest athletes taking a step back from competitions after the Olympics? I think like Yanya and Brooke said that they might be going to fewer World Cups this year. Is this like concerning to you that a lot of the big names are stepping away?
Please excuse this brief intermission, but if you're interested in deleted scenes from this episode where we talk about the unexpected politics that come with the role, for example, with dealing with the Ukraine war, do consider helping support this podcast on Patreon. Some other perks include a membership pin shipped to you after 2 months, prioritized guest questions, or the ability to submit video questions, and more to come. The proceeds go back into the podcast to help me break even, and they help me improve the experience of the guests. If you'd like to help out non-monetarily, liking, commenting, and sharing helps a great deal as well. Back to the show.
First of all, I think that we really cannot imagine the pressure that the athletes at the Olympic Games, they live, and I think we need to respect them for that. We need to understand that after this intense build-up towards the Olympic Games, they tend to need a rest, not only for their body, but also for their mind. So it's a logical thing that happens in all sports, all Olympic sports. You see that people have this kind of buildup towards a peak in four years, and then afterwards there is quite a slowdown in performance and also in participation. So yeah, we can only respect it, and that's what happens. I think a solution for this issue, if you call it an issue, is that having a good long-term calendar, where somehow we plan our events also accordingly, that we include the fact that indeed an Olympic Games is a high point in the career of an athlete. Sometimes they even build up 8 years towards it, or they dream from it if they are born. And then, so it's a high point, definitely. And we need to follow this rhythm, I think, in the calendar that we make, a long-term calendar on all levels, on the continental level, at the world level. So planning our events in a smart way, not only within the Olympic year, because in the Olympic year, indeed, last year we had the European Championship only a few weeks after the Olympic Games. It wasn't the smartest move, maybe, but it was still a successful event. But maybe we could have planned it differently, and we could have had other champions be participating as well. So yeah, making a good long-term calendar in the year itself, but also over the 4 years, might be a solution. And then secondly, I think also, if we make sure that our own events, the World Championship, the World Cups, and being the overall winner of the World Cup, or being the number one of that week or of that month of that year, somehow if this has a value or more of a value, then I think also athletes will plan accordingly and make sure that they build up within their full program towards these kind of events.
Yeah, how do you think we can build more value into winning a World Cup or the World Champs? Because I know a lot of people have mentioned that World Cups used to feel like the biggest thing, or World Champs used to feel like the biggest thing that people really want to strive for. And then since the Olympics have come into play, it just doesn't really seem like people care about it anymore.
Mm-hmm. I think in many sports, the Olympic Games are simply the biggest goal to achieve. It's so unique. You can only have it every 4 years, and you need to be a selected sport to be part of it as well. So this value of the Olympic Games, it's clearly unbeatable somehow. But then still, our own events, the World Championship and then the World Cups, how do you give them value? The easy answer is the prize money. Of course, by growing prize money, by making sure that people get also prize money for the overall title, or maybe for being number one. But also, if we make sure that the visibility of our events, that the branding of our events, the marketing around this, give more value to these events, then somehow it's also more interesting for sponsors to have athletes that are performing well at World Cup events. And maybe they don't manage to be the Olympic champion, but they are performing at World Cup events, and that way they are interesting persons. So it's not only directly in our own events with the prize money, but it's also by making the image of our events a better image or a more interesting image, that the value for sponsors gets bigger. And that way, for an athlete, it becomes more interesting to be a World Cup winner, because yeah, it makes them possible to make a living out of their passion, being a competition climber.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, definitely adding exposure would help as well, in terms of like non-immediate monetary funding, in terms of prize money. Okay, so next issue I wanted to get into, this is about like the a new rule limiting participants per country from like bigger climbing federations. What are your thoughts on that? A lot of people don't necessarily believe in like wanting to just have more climbers come in just for the sake of them getting like experience.
It's a very difficult exercise to make. In the end, we want indeed the best climbers to be able to participate at the highest level competitions, but on the other side, we also want to make it possible for all national federations to grow, to get experience, to be at the highest level of competitions, and to get connected with their NOCs, for example. I mean their National Olympic Committees, and so it's a very difficult exercise to be made. But even before this year, there was already a quota for many countries. There were already difficulties. I believe that Okay, clearly for now, Japan is the clear example as being the ones who get the biggest disadvantage of the new rule. But I think in the big countries like France, like Slovenia, there is issues with people being very performant that don't manage to get into the competitions that they would like to participate in because of quota. I remember also last year at the Olympic qualifying series, the fight between the three French athletes for the two spots.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
there is also at the Olympic level, there is this quota problem. So it happens. Now, what is the solution for it? I don't know yet. It's an exercise that we need to make with the national federations, with the commissions. We need to have discussions about, okay, how do we want to proceed with this? And it's all about this event model that I was talking about before as well. You need a pyramid with a world championship as main event at IFSC level, World Cups. You have Continental Cups, Regional Cups, and how you build up towards that. That's to be discussed. In the end, do we really need to have full quota for each and every national federation in the world championship or at the World Cup level in the future? It's a question mark. I don't have the answer. We could also go to a system where the world ranking defines who can participate in the highest level events, but then you need a world ranking system which allows people to get enough points to reach this level of those who are participating in the highest level competitions. So it's a full puzzle that you need to make, and it's not an easy exercise. And I think we just need to have this this discussion, and it will take some more time. And this year there has been made a choice. It's definitely a pity for some of the best climbers of the world. But yeah, we have to discuss this furthermore and see what the best solutions seem to be and try out.
Okay, so other than that, the next issue I think people are always talking about is the Red S policy. I know that the new policy went into effect earlier in the season. How do you think it has been working? Do you know if like people have actually been flagged for it or if any action has been taken place? Obviously not like specific names, but just whether it's really been implemented.
So I think that IFSC has been a pioneer in this approach. So we're trying something new. And as everything that is new, you might have childhood diseases in it. So I won't say that it's a perfect system. But I think somehow what the new approach to the Red S issue allowed is there is more open talks about it. Definitely. There is more consciousness about the topic. And I think also with the athletes, it's become less of a taboo to talk with it. I think more and more national federations are now having a medical person nominated to do the follow-up of their athletes. There has been talks with athletes that are maybe becoming into the danger zone. So I think that's very positive evolution for the sport. So it's less of a taboo. There is clear talks with athletes about how they are dealing with these kind of topics. And I also believe that at World Cup level, there has been tests done, I think, with over 300 tests last year. There has been talks with specific athletes that are maybe slightly between the green and the orange or that are getting into the danger zone, but not there yet. So I definitely think that we are making huge steps in the good direction, but I also believe that we need to continue evaluating the system in contact with the athletes through the athletes commission or even every athlete that wants to talk about it should be and is probably also invited by the medical commission to talk with them. We should talk with coaches, we should talk with medical experts. I think the medical commission is doing a really good job here. In Europe, we also started a health and safeguarding commission, which focuses more on the prevention side so that we can educate more coaches and youth athletes and athletes widely about this topic. So I think attacking the prevention side of it is very important as well. For example, at the European Championship last year in the Athletes Forum, we had a presentation made by the Health and Safeguarding Commission. Where there was a testimony made by Beth Rollin, about how she lived her climbing career and on this topic. And there was also an intervention from psychologist Mina Markovic, who clearly has competition experience and could talk from her own experiences as well. So I think these kind of interactions with athletes, they are really rich, and that's the way we need to continue moving forward. So yeah, Red S, it's a very difficult topic. I think IFSC is pioneering in it. We should be proud of what we are doing, but we should be critical about how we keep pushing it to become better and better. That's shortly my opinion on this topic.
I had recently interviewed someone who mentioned that there's no policy in like the youth climbing, and that's maybe like an important part to consider, because like a lot of these habits and like eating habits and eating disorders take place when they're growing up, and it's not like it's something that develops once they've like gotten older. It starts earlier than that. So do you have any thoughts there?
Yeah, it's very difficult to put a policy in place for the youth categories, because you need somehow comparable data, and you need to make it fair for each and everyone, no matter where you live, et cetera, et cetera. So it's really a difficult question to put this in place for the youth. But I think somehow for the youth, it's even more important to have the preventive approach. And it's by education. It's educating the coaches. It's making sure that each and everyone takes also his responsibility. It's national federations, coaches, parents, the people around those athletes that somehow create the circumstances in which they grow. And it's also by making it no taboo anymore that we somehow allow it to be less of an issue. So, yeah, I think rather than seeking for the policy for the youth events, it's about making sure that we do this preventive approach. And of course, if we manage to put a policy in place for our youth events, then we will do it. But I think it's more important to work on the prevention side.
Yeah, no, I think that makes sense. Yeah, because I guess like in terms of like youth athletes, I don't know, when they're like growing at such different speeds at like every age, it's like kind of hard to make an overall like call in terms of what's considered healthy or not.
Yeah, and they have their growth spurt at different moments. They have different morphology from the basis. Also, they are very vulnerable to being, how you say it, so the moment they get a stamp on their foreheads, it's really difficult for them to cope with. So we need to be really careful with the youth athletes, and we need to approach them in a very smart way. Whereas at adult level, they are more grown up. It's more stable. Normally, it should already somehow be all arranged. But then still, if there is red flags appearing, then we should act. So I think having more aggressive approach towards adults, it's a logical thing. Whereas for youth, really, we need to be cautious, and we need to, really all of us, we need to take our responsibility and do it in a healthy way, knowing that in the end, the long-term effects are more important than the short-term medals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, makes sense. And yeah, I think also just like getting rid of the taboo and like talking about it more makes people feel more comfortable with like coming forward with their stories, or coming forward if they do think they have an issue. So yeah, I think that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
So the last hot topic issue that I wanted to get into was about the Neom Beach Games. I know there was a lot of talk about that in the past few years. Yeah, I think there were some people who were pretty upset about it. And in general, what are your thoughts on hosting events in like countries that are sort of controversial?
Okay, so first of all, the Neom Games, indeed, we have had them for 2 years in a row, and there was some controversy about it, clearly. Now, this year, the Neom Games aren't on the schedule anymore, so somehow this simplifies the topic, that specific topic. But in general, if there is controversy about competitions happening in one or a specific country, I think most important to keep in mind is that somehow if IFSC organizes a competition, it is always together with a national federation, which is aligned with the values that we all share within the climbing community. And so if we do it together with a national federation, then this means also that they organize it with this spirit of mind, and they somehow also share these values with the audience that will be there, the way they organize it. And somehow it even helps us to promote the values of climbing and of our community. So in general, I would say that for the Neon Games, we won't have the controversy anymore because it's not on the schedule anymore. And if in the future these kind of things happen, I hope really that all people keep in mind that, yeah, we're a climbing family, a climbing community. We all share the same values, and it's by being present in other places where there is maybe other opinions that we at least show the opinions we have, and we can show also the way we want to live in this world. So I think it's only beneficial to be anywhere in the world. So that's my basic idea on this topic.
Perfect. Thank you for that. Okay. So I think those were most of the issues that I wanted to cover. Now going into some of the Discord questions that came through. Some of these will be a little bit more chill, I guess. So no worries there. The first one, what changes do you think we'll see to World Cup formats as the sport grows?
Ooh, you said that it wasn't going to be an easy question.
Okay. Well, that's less political, I guess, maybe.
Yeah, less political, maybe, but it's hard to look in the future. I don't know. It all depends on how we want to grow our sport. As mentioned somewhere before in the interview, I believe that maybe it is an option in the future to have a World Cup participation based upon world ranking and not necessarily a national quota.
I guess, like, what does that entail if it's just based on world ranking?
So, for example, if we really manage to put up the best show, if we only invite the 80 best of the world, then somehow we limit ourselves. We cannot allow each and every national federation to have participant there. It's a bit like in tennis, the Grand Slams. It's only the best ones who reach the top tier of the event automatically. And okay, you can have people through qualification, maybe someone get into the final weeks of the Grand Slams as well. The same kind of scheme could work for climbing, but we need to discuss it really well. And I don't think it will happen in the first 4 years. It's a discussion that needs to be had, but that's somehow the qualification system towards our own events. That might be a change. Then I think if we really talk disciplines, speed and lead are more or less stable disciplines, but on the bouldering level, clearly this year there will be the point system applied, and we need to evaluate that and see how that will develop. So those kind of changes, it's minor changes, I think, in the future, because the disciplines, they have their history already, but we need to tweak them slightly, maybe. And of course, paraclimbing, that's a big question, how that will develop over the upcoming years. What will the impact be of the Paralympic categories? Because of course, we don't want to lose any category that we have, because I think it's a really rich family of people inside the climbing community. So we need to anticipate as well, and we need to work really well to make sure that each and every climber who has climbing in his heart can continue to compete if he wants to.
Yeah, I think when you mentioned like the tennis stuff, I just remembered I watched like some random YouTube video about like tennis athletes and participation and funding in terms of career. Mm-hmm. And I just remember saying that, I mean, obviously in tennis, if you're like one of the top players, you make like millions and millions of dollars. But for anyone who's like not at that like most elite level, like the top, I don't know, 10 people or something like that, it's just like a really expensive sport to like participate in, and there's like no money there. So yeah, I guess I'm not really sure if that's something we'd want to do.
Me neither. And that's really a discussion we need to have. We need to evaluate the options. But somehow it is a reality as well that sport isn't necessarily such an example. We have in Belgium an ex-Olympic champion, world record holder in the 100 meters breaststroke, who now is selling shoes as his work, day-to-day work. Another one who's coming from judo, made bronze medal in the end of the 90s. He's now a police officer. So in the end, getting rich from sport, it's really difficult. And it's somehow for the happy few. But if with the IFSC we can manage to make a structure where we have more happy views and where overall the full scope of our organization with the route setters, with the judges, people are able to at least participate in a good way in the sport and somehow make a living out of it, or at least it's a healthy way of living, that would be a good thing. But yeah, it's impossible to make it for all athletes easy to earn a lot of money. That's impossible. But we need to make the best structure possible, and we need to continue evaluating the structure. We need not to be afraid of changing it over time, neither. But it depends on the full puzzle in the end.
Another possibility that people throw out there is like moving away from national teams towards something instead like sponsor teams, like they do in F1. What are your thoughts on that?
Of course, the national team, it gives also a certain value, being able to participate for your national team. In the end, going back to tennis, it's quite funny. In tennis, indeed, you have the pro system with the individual athlete, but in the end, they also have the Fed Cup where the national teams compete, and it's somehow a smaller kind of competition, or even football where you have the commercial teams, and then there is still the World Cup every 4 years. There is so many different ways of making the structure around the sport, and I think we just need to have good discussions with the national federations, prepared by the office, with the different commissions. Clearly, we have to have a marketing view on this, so the marketing commission needs to watch this as well. The athletes need to say what they believe is best, and together we need to come to the best solution, and indeed inspiring us in the other sports, it's a good thing. But in the end, I don't think there is a one size fits all idea, or there is we will need to reinvent ourselves more than once, and just make good choices based upon the time context that exists.
Okay, last question, much more about your own climbing. What are your climbing preferences, plastic versus rock, and your favorite climbing style?
Okay. Great question. My climbing preference clearly is with the rocks. I have spent too much time on plastic as a coach, as a climber, as a route setter. And somehow I'm climbing, unfortunately, I'm climbing less. I have a family. I'm doing a bit more of the political work. And in Belgium, it's harder to get to the rocks also. So once Corona happened, I somehow stopped a bit climbing, and right now I'm climbing 6 to 10 times a year only.
Whoa, it's like total.
Yeah, it's not enough. It's not enough. But what I miss is clearly the rocks, and it's even more so Fontainebleau. It's only 3.5 hours driving from where I live. And I used to spend 14 weekends in my best years in Fontainebleau, or I definitely love Catalonia and Siurana specifically as very nice places to go. Even though I must say that the granite from, for example, Scandinavia or in Austria, I also like. So I like the diversity of climbing, and I mostly miss the rocks and the outdoors. Even though, of course, competition climbing, the show, the emotions that are there, it's nice, but I grow myself too old for participating. That's 100% clear.
So you never did any like competing yourself?
Oh yeah, I used to do some competitions. Once I started climbing, of course, I did some recreational events. I did some national events, Belgian Cups, some Belgian Championship even. But I started too late, and I was already too much focused on coaching others. Luckily, I did do some nice performances on the rocks, but competition-wise, I was only at national level.
Well, only, okay.
Yeah, Belgium is a small country, you know?
Sure, so. Yeah. Is there, how do you feel about like competition-style moves now? Do you ever do those kinds of climbs?
It's very interesting to see how it evolves, and of course, in the past, some people were really strong and others were not. But nowadays, all are strong, and you still need to give them the challenges that they cannot make. You don't want all people to succeed in everything. So I understand that we had a tendency to introduce these kind of moves, and they are definitely spectacular. They are skills that are interesting to develop. And the funny thing is that I still notice that all the strong competition climbers are also amongst the really strong rock climbers. Mm-hmm. So it's not that there is a complete difference between competition style and the outdoor style, for example. And I understand that some people are a bit, how would you say that? It's not homesick, but they want to go back a bit to the old style. But yeah, if you want to climb old style, you can still have old style once in a while. But it's good to have a diversity, and it's a natural evolution, and we cannot stop it necessarily. But what is important, I think, is that we somehow maintain indeed diversity, and we don't make, not every competition need to be the same style of once every week. The same would be a bit boring as well.
Is there like a favorite competition style move that you like to do, like climb on?
When I was actively climbing and setting, I just like to put in dynos, of course.
Okay.
But nowadays, it's so diverse, and I wouldn't say there is one specific one that I would choose, no.
All right, cool. Well, I think that's all the questions I had then. Thanks for joining me today. Is there any like last minute words of wisdom that you want to get out there?
Ooh, words of wisdom. I'm too young to be wise, maybe. No, definitely. I believe climbing is a really beautiful sport with lots of beautiful people being involved. And if we can manage to all work together, cooperate, and to help each other to continue the growth that we are living now, keeping true to our values, I really hope that can happen. And if that happens, then probably we can indeed make a better world through sports climbing, which is the vision of the IFSC, and which is a vision that I align with a lot. So let's just build all together on this nice sport.
And do you want to let people know where they can find you if they have any further questions or thoughts?
I'm already a bit old school, but still Instagram works, as you noticed, because you could reach out to me through Instagram. So yeah, indeed, if people would like to reach out to me, they can easily find me on Instagram and then send me a message, and I will happily reply to all decent questions.
Decent questions. So you don't want like hate mail or anything like that? Is that what you mean?
I think, I heard recently from a very known, famous female athlete, the amount of wrong pictures that she receives. And
oh,
I
gosh.
Think it's really okay. A pity to hear that that's the reality for female athletes. I didn't realize it until I had a talk with her, and I don't understand how we come to this point, but unfortunately it's the truth. So I won't risk to receive those kind of pictures, I guess. But
okay, so you don't want pictures if people want to send hate, is that okay?
No, I'm just in general. It's funny. No, of course people should act respectfully to each other always. So I think
constructive criticism, maybe.
Yes. Indeed.
Okay. Gotcha. Okay. Well, yeah, thank you for talking to me. Thanks for joining. Thanks for answering all the hard questions. Mm-hmm. And it was amazing to talk to you.
Yeah. Thanks a lot. It was a pleasure also. Thanks for all the questions.
Thank you so much for making it to the end of the podcast. Don't forget to like and subscribe if you enjoyed. Otherwise, you are a super big climber. If you're listening on a podcasting platform, I'd appreciate if you rate it 5 stars, and you can continue the discussion on the free competition climbing Discord linked in the description. Thanks again for listening.